Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Math. I'm your host, Jim Stein. Today we are talking about the book, The Golden Ticket, PNP, and the Search for the Impossible. It was written by Professor Lance Fortnow, now of Georgia Tech University, and he's going to talk about it. Lance, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Jim. Nice to be here.
Lance, I was fascinated by this book. It was a very, very easy to read book, and I found that I was enjoying it because it was entertaining, and it got to the point where I realized that this was a problem that once solved could have a tremendous impact on our lives. And I think that made it very, very interesting for me because the vast majority of mathematics questions, when they're solved, only the mathematicians know about it. This is one that once we solve it, it's going to be truly a fascinating question. Anyway, what I would like to do is I'd like you to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Okay. So right now I'm currently chair of the School of Computer Science at Georgia Tech, as you said. I grew up in the New York City, New Jersey area. Let's say I did my undergrad at Cornell and I got my PhD at MIT. And I spent many, many years in the Chicago area working at University of Chicago and Northwestern. In fact, I mean, we just moved down to Georgia last summer. And I have, two beautiful teenage daughters. And a loving wife.
Excellent. Anyway, I guess the first question that I'd like to ask you is, tell the listeners a little bit about the PNP problem so they understand what the book is about and what it's concerned with.
Okay, so the PNP problem, I don't want to get into the technical definitions of it, but roughly what the idea is to try to capture what kinds of problems we could solve quickly on a computer. What are the great computational challenges that we are able to solve or are we not able to solve? And that's what the PNP question is trying to ask. So a standard example would be what's known as the traveling salesman problem. Traveling salesman problem, where the question is, if you're a traveling salesman, salesperson, maybe, and you want to visit 50 cities, it doesn't matter what order you visit them, but you want to minimize the total amount of time it takes to travel between all these cities, can you find the shortest possible route? And so there's a problem like that, and there are several other related problems, and whether or not we can solve them relates to a mathematical question known as the PNP problem.
Okay. One of the things that is interesting about this problem is that the Clay Institute at the turn of the century had, I think, 7 $1 million Millennium Challenge problems in mathematics. And the PNP problem was one of them, and the others seem to be very abstract, but this one's real down to earth. Do you have any idea how this problem got selected as one of the $1 million challenge problems?
Let me go a little bit further back than that. So when I grew up, there was this long-standing 350-year-old problem known as Fermat's Last Theorem, a very simple distinct mathematical question that every kid kind of grew up, you know, imagining that they would solve and solve this incredibly great mathematical challenge that was left open for centuries. And then it actually did get solved by Andrew Wiles in the 90s. And so what I think the Clay Math Institute was trying to do was create a new set of problems to get people very excited by mathematics, by getting them by saying, listen, there's these huge mathematical questions and that we really want to get settled. And they have a large list of implications throughout mathematics, and in some cases, you know, outside mathematics as well. So I think that they set upon this challenge in the 90s to come up with this list. They would call it the Millennium Problems, and they would actually give $1 million bounty on each of these problems to underscore their importance. And I heard there was a lot of discussion about whether or not to include the PNP problem because some people felt it was, in some sense, too practical a question. But really, if you do look deeply into it, it is fundamentally a very deep mathematical question, isn't it? So it really talks about the nature of, it ties in closely with logic and with, and just with a number, there really is a deep mathematical nature to the question beyond, you know, the connections to real world computation, which kind of drove the problem. And so and because of that, I think that it, and it's just in general importance, that it actually became one of these Millennium Problems that the Clay Math Institute wanted to underscore the importance of.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting about your book and was the fact that the solution of this problem could have a dramatic effect on our lives. And that was something that really opened my eyes, especially when you started discussing something that you called the beautiful world. And I thought that was a fascinating way to bring this problem down to earth. And I wondered whether or not you could spend a few moments discussing the idea of how solving this problem would create such a fantastic difference in our lives.
Okay, so I should first remark that we don't know which way it will be resolved, you know, whether we say P equals NP and all these problems are easy, or P not equal NP and then some of these problems are just difficult to solve. And then, so in my book, I try to deal with both possibilities. And so the beautiful world is what I call in this, it's, you know, what I've been calling to myself my science fiction chapter of the book, where I try to imagine this world where what would happen if P equals NP. And it's really, so P equals NP means that all these computational challenges we're trying to solve would actually become easy. At least P equals NP in spirit, you know, says that. So it's amazing when you look at what's going on in science today or in medicine or in pretty much every aspect, how much of the challenges we're facing are algorithmic, not just, you know, a trying to solve large-scale problems. And so, for example, a lot of cancer research is trying to analyze, you know, how does DNA affect proteins and how can we tailor, how can we recognize cancer and design proteins that would attack the cancer cells or leaving the rest of the cells untouched. But if P were equal to NP, those kinds of computations might become very simple, so it might be very easy to solve, to cure diseases like cancer and other diseases just algorithmically in some sense. I mean, you know, obviously a lot of biologists may have to go through it too, but to remove the algorithmic challenges would make huge advances in medicine. I also talk about, you know, it would make it much easier to, it would make it much easier to learn things. You could build instant language translators. I mean, we have some with like Google, but you can make them completely natural. We can have the universal translator that we saw on Star Trek, for example, where we could have perfect learning of anything. And we could even imagine a world where You could recreate even sort of works of art. You could imagine learning certain skills and actually able to create new novels or music based on what was known before, just by analyzing it using algorithmic tools that would be possible if you were going to. But I need to emphasize that, in fact, I do this chapter to try to excite people about the PNP problem. I do want to emphasize the fact that most computer scientists don't think that P is equal to NP, that we're not likely to be in this beautiful world, and that these computational challenges will remain very difficult. And so I spend a considerable part of my book saying, well, just because they're difficult doesn't mean they're impossible, and how are people trying to deal with these challenges? And I think understanding if we're able to actually prove that P is different from NP, that should give us insight to understand why these problems are hard. It should, in a sense, would also give us insight to how do we attack them individually by getting around these hard issues. How we sort of deal with the hard challenges and understand what we can and can't do.
I think one of the things that might be worth spending a couple of minutes on is actually defining what you consider to be an algorithm, because people in mathematics think of mathematics as talking about things such as equations and angles and stuff like that. An algorithm sort of seems beyond the scope of mathematics, and so maybe you could familiarize our listeners with it.
So not at all. Not at all. So an algorithm is really nothing more than, in some sense, a computer program. It's the best way to think about it. And what is a computer program? But a computer program is just a series of characters. You write a computer program and you pick whatever your favorite programming language is. And what is a computer program? It's just a series of characters. So it's basically can be encoded as a number in some sense. And so you can interpret an algorithm mathematically the same way you can interpret a geometric figure like a triangle or square, or a concept like complex numbers. Or any other sort of mathematical object. You can formally give a mathematical definition of what an algorithm is. And we can give a formal definition of what it can do thanks to the work of a brilliant mathematician from the 30s, Alan Turing, who actually created what was called the Turing machine, which actually gave a formal mathematical definition of you know what an algorithm computes. So there's no problem in completely formalizing this whole process. I try to avoid that in the book pretty much because I was trying to aim the book at a more general audience. But there is no problem. The P versus NP problem, I do want to emphasize, is a very well defined mathematical question. Even in the book, I try to talk more about the spirit of PNP than the actual mathematical definitions instead. So an algorithm is just really computer code. It's really just a list of characters. That's all that it really, really is as far as a mathematical object. And the challenge, though, is to understand even a very simple program. It's very difficult to understand what that program actually does. that's where the real challenge lies. And that's where it's very hard to analyze these things.
You mentioned Alan Turing's work in the 1930s. Would you think that actually, because it starts the idea of formal computation, that's where the history of the P versus NP problem might actually begin, or maybe the prehistory? And maybe you could catch our listeners up with the actual history, because as I understand it, and as you presented it in your book, it ties in with the Cold War.
Yeah, in the sense that there was very little communication during the Cold War. So for some of you younger listeners, the Cold War was this period from after World War II until the late 80s, until about 1990, where there were basically two superpowers, Russia and America, and what Winston Churchill called the Iron Curtain that sort of separated the two, that ran through, separated Western and Eastern Europe. And there wasn't a lot of scientific collaboration or communication. There was some, but not a lot, between both sides, because there was a lot of scientific competition, mostly expressed in the space race, for example, which is kind of a shame. So we really, it was really a period where there was quite a lot done in science and in math, where efforts are being duplicated both on one side and the other. And this is and the PNP problem is actually an example of that. In America, what happens is around the 60s, people were starting to ask, computers. So, Alan Turing had his idea of computation come up in the 30s, but we didn't have computers back then. He was actually trying to understand the power of mathematicians' thinking. But he actually ended up coming up with a great notion of what computation is. It still stands to today. But what happened in the 60s, people started asking, now we have real-world computers, but it seems that there are some problems which are hard to solve on computers and some problems which aren't. And so there was a lot of work in the 60s trying to classify how do I analyze the computational power of programs. And then there was a 1965 paper by Urs Arminas and Richard Stearns that really sort of defined this area, sort of gave us a way to measure the amount of computation time it takes to solve a problem. Later in the 60s, this notion of what efficient computation, and work by Alan Cobham and Jack Edmonds, sort of different work, that kind of understood what it meant to be efficiently computable, to efficiently solve some problems. And then in the early 70s is where we really saw this notion of NP come out. In a seminal paper by Steve Cook, he showed a certain problem in logic was very hard to compute unless all the problems like it are hard to compute. And then in a follow-up paper by Richard Karp a year later in 72, he showed that a whole slew of very natural problems that people are trying to attack were all computationally equivalent, and computationally equivalent to the PNP problem. And that really got the ball rolling. And from there, there was a large amount of work after that, trying to understand the power of, what kinds of problems are hard to solve. And people tried to start attacking the PNP problem, with not much progress. On the Russian side, what happened was a bit different. The mathematical society in Russia was much more controlled and centralized, as you might imagine. There was a professor in Russia by the name of Leblonsky who had done some work related to a concept, a beautiful word they have is peribor, which means brute force search. And so they want to understand the power of what they call peribor, which turns out to be related, at least spiritually, to the PNP problem. Leblonsky had done some work, and then he claimed that the problem was settled, which kind of prevented the Russians from kind of doing further research on it. Luckily, there was a little sort of rascal by the name of Leonard Levin, who in the early 70s wrote a paper where he managed to actually come up independently of Steve Cook, Steve Cook was a candidate at the time. He actually came up with the same notion of this PNP problem in a very short paper that he wrote in the early 70s as well. In reality, Leonard Levin, although we didn't find out about Levin's work until the late 70s, as I said, in the U.S. So it really was kind of went through a different circuitous route in Russia than it did in America, but we ended up at the same place. And that's, I think that's a good sign, because that means if two different independent sort of groups kind of come up with the same idea, that really underscores the importance of the idea. That this idea, which came out of nowhere, really came to be the same idea from both the Russians and from, the Americans.
I see that the idea of brute force computation is necessary to solve certain problems. And one of the things that I also enjoyed about the book, and I think some of our younger listeners will too, was that you were able to put some problems in sort of a Facebook context. And I wonder if you could do that now, some problems such as Clique, for instance.
Yeah, so just that this is an example I love to use. It's so a clique is just, it's a group of people who are all friends of each other. And so in Facebook, it's clear what this means because two people are either friends with each other or they're not. So a clique is just a whole group of people where every pair of people in a group are friends with each other. So you can imagine, you know, it's a group of friends. Like my daughter has this group of eight friends she hangs out with, and they form a clique because they're all friends with each other on Facebook. So let me ask the question. What is the largest clique in Facebook? Ask that question. Nobody really knows. You could guess maybe it's 100, maybe it's 200, maybe it's 50. Nobody really knows. But you really can't solve that problem. First of all, you don't have access to the data. Facebook guards its data because it cares about the privacy of people. It's also its data is very valuable. So you can't get access to the Facebook data to try to analyze it. But suppose you actually worked at Facebook. So you can imagine someone working at Facebook and, you know, someone might want to question, what is the largest clique? What's the largest group of people on Facebook who are all friends with each other? And so with someone at Facebook, you'd say, well, sure, they could just write a computer program to solve that problem. And now the first approach you would use is you know, brute force search, Paravore, as we said. But the problem with that, if you look at all groups, well, you look at all possible, you know, Facebook has, what, a billion people, at least, I mean, close to a billion possible members. If you look at all groups of size 100 among a billion groups, that number is so big. You know, the amount of time, doesn't matter how fast the computers are, you're never going to solve it within the end of the universe. There's just no hope. So brute force search doesn't work. There's just too many possibilities, too many possible groups to look at. And so the question is, we don't know if brute force search is necessary to solve this problem. In fact, that's exactly what the PNP problem asks. So maybe there's some other very clever algorithm that doesn't need to do this whole brute force search, but uses some other very clever idea that somehow finds this largest clique in Facebook. And that's what the PNP problem captures. Whether there is some different kind of algorithm, and I don't know what it's going to look like. Nobody knows what it might look like. Probably doesn't exist at all, but we don't know. Maybe there's some clever algorithm. Is there some clever algorithm that will actually find, you know, these large groups of people in Facebook that all know each other?
Well, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, one of the things that was done in this area is that they showed that there was a whole class of problems, such as clique, all of which were, in some sense, equally difficult. And it struck me that when I was looking at it and you said, well, we have this beautiful world if P equals NP, meaning basically we can solve these difficult problems. In mathematics, or at least in the branch of mathematics that I know, there's a difference between showing that a solution exists and being able to find it. And it struck me that you might be able to show that a whole bunch of problems are equivalently difficult and maybe they are all relatively easy to solve, but don't you have to sort of attack each problem on a problem-by-problem basis? Or is there sort of one general idea which might cause a whole bunch of different problems, like, say, traveling salesman and clique, to fall simultaneously?
So what we show are problems, well, not what I showed, but what Richard Karp showed in the 72 paper was that problems like traveling salesman and clique are equivalent, as you had said, computation equivalent. And what they did was they used the notion of what's called a reduction. So they showed that if I had an algorithm that could solve the clique problem, you could modify that algorithm relatively easily to solve the traveling salesman problem, or vice versa. You could solve the traveling salesman problem, you could modify that algorithm to solve the clique problem. So if someone were to come up with a clever algorithm for clique, the clique problem in Facebook, you could take that algorithm and use it with some modification. You have to add a little modification, but we know how to do that modification. that modification is already known. If I had some magic algorithm that could solve Clique, we now know how to take that algorithm, that magic algorithm for Clique, and turn it into an algorithm for traveling salesmen. So the nice thing in the beautiful world is you can take a single algorithm. If P were equal NP, there'd be a single algorithm that would solve one of these hard problems, and then we could easily modify it to solve all the remaining problems as well.
I thought that was absolutely fascinating, but also there's another aspect to it, which when you mention the beautiful world, that there's sort of an ugly underbelly to the beautiful world, and that's that all of a sudden we have widespread unemployment because computers are doing even more stuff than we are today, and privacy is basically out the window. And so one of the things that sort of worried me is, do you think the gain from these faster algorithms would offset the sociological consequences? And I realize neither one of us is a sociologist, so we're just speculating here, but you're in an area which can do a better job of it than I could.
So first of all, I want to make this, I don't know. The answer is, this would be such a change. You know, if you asked me in the 90s, how is the internet going to change society? I would never have guessed where we are today. So it'd be very hard to say what would happen exactly. People wouldn't have to work because everything would be, it'd be so cheap and easy to do. So who knows what would happen? But let me make a very strong point. These are not issues that we're only gonna have to worry about if we get to P and N, if P equals NP. These are issues we're actually dealing with right now. Right now, we're dealing with issues that, for example, we're currently in the middle of a jobless recovery. And, the stock markets are doing very well, but the unemployment rate has not come down significantly. And part of the argument some people are making is that we've become so efficient in many, computers have gotten so good at many of the tasks we're currently doing that some of these jobs are just not coming back. So it's an issue, and there's also it's not hard to follow the news. Huge discussions about the loss in privacy from the ability of computers to search immense amounts of data, in different ways. Already, even without having people's input. So these are issues that we need to confront now. These are not issues. And these issues, would get a lot much worse if people aren't here. But even now, these are issues that are confronting computer scientists. The loss of privacy, issues of security, issues for job loss, whether nobody knows 100% whether or not this is related to increased technology and computation. But these are difficult problems, and it's not clear what the right approach is, or if there's even anything we could do to change it.
I think also one of the things that it's interesting is when you talk about privacy and such things as computer passwords, that this is actually related to the problem of factoring large numbers. And possibly you could trace a little bit of the history of this, because it's something that intimately concerns all of us. We all worry about, can somebody hack into our passwords? Can somebody steal our bank account?
So, this was a beautiful insight that came sort of more in the late 70s, that you could use the difficulty of certain kinds of problems, like NP problems, to be able to do cryptographic things. What happened in the 70s is cryptography moved from an art to a science. So before the 70s, people would just try to create hard codes, and then people would try to break them, but there was no sort of mathematics behind it. After the 70s, people actually developed mathematical techniques that let us produce hard cryptographic functions based on mathematical problems like factoring. Because factoring has interest. It turns out that if I give you a number, it's relatively easy to tell whether or not the number is prime. So a prime number means that it doesn't have any factors other than the number in itself. It's very easy to tell whether or not a number has different factors. But even if you know that a number is not prime, even if you know the number has multiple factors, it turns out that, as far as we know, it's very computationally difficult to find those factors. So we can actually use those factors as a secret password for an encryption process that can't be broken unless you can factor those numbers. And so a lot of modern cryptography is sort of based on that principle. And if it turns out that P equals the unlikely event, again, let me emphasize that, you know, P equals NP is still what I believe an unlikely event, that P equals NP. It would take away that ability to, you'd be able to factor numbers easy. You'd be able to break these kinds of codes easily. It's not clear what would happen with cryptography. I mean, a lot of the techniques we use now would be gone, but there's other kinds of tricks you could possibly play. So you might be able to deal with that thing. So also in cryptography, there's other ways to break into systems other than breaking the code. In fact, usually it's bad implementations that let people break into systems. So cryptography is not enough for security, and security is a very tough problem. It's another issue that we have to, you know, even though we don't know P equals NP or not, the difficulty in maintaining secure systems is a problem that is really keeping a lot of people up at night.
I seem to remember that in maybe the 70s or 80s, papers on number theory in this particular area were classified by the government because they felt that it was so important to security that maybe we better keep this stuff secret. And some mathematicians were required to have security clearance. But I think that the idea of public key systems arose at around that time, and maybe you could explain these.
There were some systems. Yeah, I mean, the government did try to block some publications of papers. For the most part, they were not successful. So most of the stuff did end up being published, except, you know, obviously the people who actually work at the NSA. We never know what's going on inside that agency. Now, as far as public key crypto, so what's a public key crypto system? So we have this amazing ability. I can go on the internet from my computer or at work or at home. I can connect to Facebook or to my bank, and we can exchange information. I can exchange information with my bank over the internet, where someone listening on the internet can read every discussion the two of us have and not have any clue what we're saying to each other. And that's known as public key cryptography. It's a way for two people who've never met and never been able to exchange a secret in private, still able to have a conversation that no one else can follow. And the basic way that it works is that what a Facebook would do or what a bank would do is they would publish what's called a public key. They just publish a certain kind of value. And now, with the public key, you can encrypt information, but it doesn't go the other way. You can't decrypt it. So I can use the public key to take my message and encrypt it to make it look like a random piece of nonsense. And then that's what I send over to Facebook. Now, Facebook created this public key, but also part of that public key. Now, typically, what a public key and private key are, typically, like for example, a public key might be a large number, and a private key are the factors of that number. And what Facebook did was take two large prime numbers, both lying together, and get this larger number. It publishes the larger number. That lets me send secret messages, but it does know the original factors. So Facebook, once it gets this encrypted message, can decrypt it because it has a private key that lets it decrypt. So that's kind of the way this public key cryptography lets us talk to each other, lets us actually communicate having never met or never discussed secrets before, and yet able to still produce secret messages. And that would all go away if P were equal. So if P equals NP, you cannot have public key cryptography. We would have to have some sort of way of exchanging secret keys. I don't know how, but but we'd have to go back to that old-fashioned way of cryptography if it turned out to P were equal.
One of the things that I think I found interesting about your book was even in the event that P is not equal to NP, and I gather that this is sort of the majority opinion in the computer science community, even so, there are still ways to make inroads on various difficult to solve problems, because even if P isn't equal to NP, and even if we don't have a beautiful world, we'd still like to be able to get, if we can't get a perfect solution to the traveling salesman problem, we'd certainly settle for one that was pretty close to good as long as we could compute it.
That's right. So, I mean, the problem is you have these hard problems. That doesn't mean we don't need to solve them. So, there's even if they're very hard, even if P doesn't equal NP, which means we can't solve them all the time exactly, there's a lot of things we could do. We can solve medium-sized problems just by brute force search because computers have just gotten so much faster through the years. So often, you know, if it's a problem on, if you're doing a traveling salesman problem on a few dozen cities, for example, or even 100 cities with some slightly cleverer algorithms, you can actually just solve them because we can just use very fast computers with some, you know, some small tricks to save a little bit of the search time. Also, you can write algorithms called heuristics, which don't always give the correct answer, but often do, or approximation algorithms, as you said, which kind of gets you answers which may not be the absolute best, shortest path, gets something close to the shortest possible path through all the cities, which is often, again, very useful. So there are a number of different things, or you can do some combination of all of the above. Or maybe try to solve it. You know, if one problem is computationally difficult to solve, well, then maybe you modify your problem. You reach your goal through a different computational process, and that might be computationally easier to do. So there's a lot of different kinds of ways you can kind of tackle these hard to solve problems because we have to solve them, and in these cases, we just really need to solve these computational challenges. So we just need to do the best we can, and so there's a lot of research, a lot of computation, a lot of work on how do we solve these problems as best we can. And there's been a lot of great progress along these lines.
This sort of gets back to something that I was asking you about earlier when you said that I think it was Cook showed that, either Cook or Karp showed that a couple of different problems could be solved equivalently simply by modifying the solution for one, the algorithm that solved one, to get an algorithm that solved the other. That's for the best, I guess I would call it the best solution, the perfect solution. But does the same thing happen with these approximate solutions or heuristics? If you have an approximate solution to the, say, the traveling salesman problem, can you modify that appropriately to get as good an approximate solution for the clique problem?
So that gets a bit more complicated in some cases. So the answer to your specific question is we don't think so. We actually know good approximation algorithms for traveling salesmen. We don't believe there are good approximation algorithms, and for reasons that I don't want to get too far into. When you start getting into those kinds of questions, there are some connections, but the connections aren't as global as they were in, for the specific, for the problems that solve everything. And then it becomes more of a problem by problem. There are some problems where we can tie the approximations together, and there are some problems which just seem very hard to approximate. In fact, some things where, there are some cases where we can show that you can't approximate unless P equals NP, unless you can solve it exactly. So it becomes a more of a problem by problem case in that case. So it's no longer that you can make sweeping general statements.
In regard to that question that you can only show that there's a good solution if P equals NP, is there any problem that you could describe of that character that would be relatively easy to understand, or are they all highly technical ones?
Well, I think clique is actually the best example. It turns out that we can actually show that no algorithm can get even a halfway decent approximation on clique. You can actually take an algorithm that gets a reasonable approximation in clique and turn it into a new algorithm that solves clique exactly. So,
wow.
Clique is an example of something where we don't even think it's going to be, there's even a way to approximate cliques in general very easily.
That's extremely interesting. One of the things that I've read about is the idea that there may be quantum computers which can solve some of these problems. Are you able to tell us a little bit about how quantum computation might be able to at least make these problems a little easier?
Yeah, it's tricky because it's quantum is still, we're trying to understand what the power of quantum actually is. The quantum computer, the idea is that there are these quantum effects, so that information is entangled in a way that defies our sort of common notion of how information works. So it gets very tricky. There are very mathematical descriptions of these things. It's a very messy thing. There was a beautiful result by Peter Shor in the mid-90s, where he showed that if you could build a quantum computer, and I mean, make it clear, no one's yet built a large, you know, even a medium-scale quantum computer. But if you could build a quantum computer, you could factor numbers quickly. So the problem of factoring numbers is something that could be solved quickly with the hypothetical quantum computer. But these quantum computers could imagine that. I mean, there's some physics and engineering things you have to deal with, but you could imagine that these machines could actually exist in the future. Now, it turns out that factoring, while we think it's a hard problem to solve, we don't think it's as hard as problems like clique. So people generally don't believe that quantum computers are going to make a significant impact on the really hardest of entry problems, like thinking traveling salesmen. They might help us solve them a little bit faster, but they're not going to help us really solve large-scale problems efficiently. That's the general belief, but I think it's still too early to tell exactly how powerful quantum computers are going to be and what kinds of problems they're going to help us solve.
I think also one of the things that I noticed was that the idea of biological computation, which I don't know whether or not you mention in the book, but I live in Southern California, and a friend of mine teaches in the computer science department at USC, and there's a guy named Len Edelman there who is responsible for the algorithm that helps you do public key, private key cryptography. And also, I think in the 90s, he discovered a way to get biological organisms to do certain types of computations. But even though there was sort of a brief interest in that, I think that's sort of limited also. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, so I'm very familiar with the work. Yeah, Len Edelman, as you're right, is part of, you know, the RSA. He's the A in RSA, which is sort of the standard public key cryptography algorithm that's used today. You're right, and in the 90s, he had this beautiful work where he was able to solve, I think, small traveling salesman problems by mixing up, you know, creating certain biological sequences and, you know, mix them up in test tubes and until the appropriate traveling salesman problem appeared as a solution. So that stuff is really just amazing that you can even use biological computing to produce these kinds of solutions. But the limitations of these computers are not really solving problems in a fundamentally different way. They're able to do this kind of parallelism by mixing up things in a little test tube. But exponential growth, the problem with most NP problems, the brute force search, is that as you grow the size of the problem, number of possibilities, like every time you grow it a little bit, the number of possibilities doubles. And that doubling effect is very dramatic. And so while he could solve maybe, I don't know exactly how large a problem, maybe 20, 30 city traveling salesman problems he was able to solve, if he wants to start solving 1,000 size or 10,000 size cities, now you'd have to mix up, you know, biological things in the size of an ocean or larger. And, you know, it doesn't scale. I mean, it was beautiful that he was able to do this at all, you know, even on small scale problems. But unfortunately, it doesn't really scale to solve large problems. So it's unlikely that you're actually going to be able to solve problems with your biological computing. at least in that way, than you are. I mean, it might speed up a little bit traditional computing, but I don't think you're not going to be able to solve large scale problems using biological computing because it doesn't scale in the ways that make it that useful.
One of the things that I felt about your book that I personally found resonated with me, and I think will probably with a lot of our older listeners, is the idea of being able to come up with personalized treatments for cancer based on what might be called the protein folding problem. And I wonder if you could expand on this a little and whether there are other biological problems that you know of that discovering that P equals NP and an algorithm that can manage to attack these problems in a fairly quick fashion, biological problems that might be conceivably solved and might better our lives.
So, everything I'm going to say you should take with a grain of salt because biology is not my strength. I don't have a strong background in biology. But the key to a lot of these things is we don't understand. So there's this notion of protein folding. This notion, if you create a certain DNA, a protein, a certain kind of DNA sequence, that will cause that protein will actually cause the fold it in a certain way that lets it connect with other proteins. You know, proteins connect through their geometries. This is very high scale, and I might be completely wrong. So again, this is sort of how it works. But we really don't understand that process. It's very hard to predict, given a sequence, how it's going to fold. Or even more, to invert that process, which is what you really need to do. You need to find a protein that looks like a certain kind of shape. How do we design a sequence to create that protein? And if P would equal NP, we should be able to discover both these answers. We should be able to understand the process that describes how protein folds, and also understand the process of how to create a sequence, a DNA, you know, the appropriate sequence of amino acids or whatever that would actually create the protein that we actually needed to attack a certain kind of disease. You know, that would fold in a certain way that it would allow it to attack cancer cells but not attack other kinds of cells. So, the P equals, if P were to equal NP, we should be able to solve this right away. But I want to, you know, again, even if it turns out that P is not equal to NP or we'll never be able to show P were to equal NP, still, you know, these are kinds of computational challenges people are still trying to attack, and I suspect we will make significant progress along these lines, as our computers get faster, as we're able to tackle some of these problems. We may not understand it completely, but hopefully enough. We will be able to attack some of the computational issues that could help us attack diseases in the future.
One of the things that I've noticed in college and also in graduate schools is that there are now many more programs in areas such as biomathematics. You find that there are, you know, that there are positions open at various colleges for people who specialize in biomathematics. And I would hope that there's sort of more of a communication between the biological community and the computer science community in order so that they both might work jointly on these problems. Because, for instance, even if the protein folding problem can't be solved as part of P equals NP, maybe it's possible that a combination of computer scientists and biologists could come up with an approximate solution that might be able to greatly improve our chances of fighting cancer.
Well, that's an excellent point, and there is a large area known as bioinformatics that tries to do exactly that. I wish there was more communication. I think, unfortunately, I think there are a lot of language and cultural issues that make communication between different disciplines more difficult than it should be. But I think everyone agrees that we need to sort of improve that communication, be able to use the tools for computer science and the tools for biology. Like, you know, I know some computer science tools. My knowledge of biology is very limited. So that we can understand exactly what are the right algorithmic challenges and figure out the right tools to attack those challenges in biology. So, I mean, we're trying to do that here in at Georgia Tech. It's trying to get people talking to each other. And, you know, we have connections with Emory, because, you know, most, Emory has this law medical school. Georgia Tech doesn't have a medical school. And I think a lot of other institutions, or, you know, MIT certainly has strong groups. I mean, they're just strong groups across the country trying to deal with exactly these issues. It's very difficult. These are difficult computational challenges. It's difficult to try to understand what even the right questions to ask are. I mean, that's the real problem. It's really, we're still in the stage where we're trying to figure out what are the right questions to ask.
I think that's very well put, because one of the things that I've noticed is that it's very easy for mathematicians to talk to physicists simply because they're dealing with what are essentially relatively simple systems. And as you get further away from physics and nearer to biology, the systems get more and more complex. And we just don't yet have the mathematics to cope with a lot of the questions that biology would want to know. And so as a result, what they have is they have a lot of tools that they can use on a technological basis. But in terms of computational and theoretical structure that interfaces well with mathematics, not so much.
Somehow physics seems much closer tied to mathematics than biology does, but there's certainly a growing movement in biology and bioinformatics to try to connect those connections. So I'm hopeful for the future.
As someone who's getting on in years, I'm glad to hear it. Anyway, Lance, I'd like to thank you for being on our show, and I wonder if you'd tell our listeners what you're working on at the moment.
Okay, so what I've been doing in recent years is actually connecting with the economics community. Particularly when I was at Northwestern, I was working with some economists on the business school there. Because there's a lot of issues you can kind of view sort of people dealing with each other. Normally we think of economics as dealing with how people deal with money and these kinds of issues. But there's a lot of computational underpinnings there. Economists, I mean, if you have a large market, for example, trying to figure out what the best choice to make is often a difficult computational question. And so I've been trying to take the tools from computational complexity, the work that I do, and find how do we use the tools and models from my world and apply it to economic models to help us understand how the economic models work better. And in some cases, even vice versa, I've been able to use some tools from economics and apply it to computational models. So that's been a lot of my recent work, is trying to tie these two fields together. I think there's a lot of potential.
Do you think that might lead to another book?
We've got a lot more to do before I'm ready on that topic.
Okay, Lance, thanks again so much for being on the show.
Thanks for the time to talk. It's been great.
I'm Jim Stein, the host of New Books in Math. Goodbye.